Welcome to NYU Langone Insights on Psychiatry, a clinician's guide to the latest psychiatric research. I'm Dr. Thea Gallagher. Each episode, I interview a leading psychiatric researcher about how their work is shaping clinical practice. Today, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Ronald Kessler, professor of healthcare policy at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Kessler is a giant in the field of medicine. His groundbreaking work on the social determinants of mental health has made him the most widely cited researcher in all of psychiatry. And now he's leading efforts to take psychiatry into the era of precision medicine. In our conversation, we talked about why precision psychiatry has been relatively slow to arrive, what it will mean for clinicians, and how he's using machine learning to identify at-risk patients and craft individualized treatment plans. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Kessler, for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Can you give us an overview of your current research interests, especially as they relate to precision psychiatry?
Yeah, I'm a psychiatric epidemiologist, and for many years, my work was purely community descriptive epidemiology, estimating the prevalence and correlates of mental disorders. And I did look at treatment, you know, how many people got treatment and barriers to treatment and stuff like that. But I never did clinical epidemiological stuff. And clinical epidemiological stuff is, by and large, looking at what are the predictors of whether treatment works. And that's kind of is nowadays called precision psychiatry, because there are a lot of fancy statistical methods to look at that. And in the past decade or so, I've gotten involved in doing more of this clinical epidemiological stuff. Initially, through my involvement in something called the Army STARS study, which is an ongoing, very large initiative with many different studies inside of it, of suicide among people in the U.S. military. And we started in, 2011, a few years after the rise in the suicide rate among military people was first observed, and we were asked by the Department of Army to come in and see if we could have an outsider's perspective to see what's going on and what could be done. And so typically, psychiatric epidemiologists are never asked those kind of questions. You know, we're usually sort of on the outside saying, hey, look, mental disorders is a big problem. Somebody should do something about that someday. But nobody really comes to ask us what to do. So this was sort of a unique, actually really unique opportunity, unique in the sense that the military is a big organization and it has an unbelievable amount of data. You know, in stuff I've done subsequently and where I spend most of my time now working in commercial health plans and in the Veterans Administration, we have medical and pharmacy claims data and procedure codes and test results. And sometimes we bring in data about the neighborhood where the person lives so you can look at social determinants of health. But in the active military, we have IQ tests, personality tests, blood samples, performance ratings, criminal justice data, because the military runs their own police force. We have child and protective services data because the military runs its own social welfare. I mean, we just have this unbelievable wealth of information. I for many years, found myself being very jealous of people in Scandinavia because they had all these registry data. But actually now, in working in the active duty military, I have much more than they have in those registries. Because as I said, we have like, say, IQ. When somebody joins the military, they get an IQ test. They also get blood samples taken. So we have access to that. We have personality scales because the military uses personality tests to help figure out what's the right, you know, the right occupation for the person when they come in. So we started looking there at risk factors for suicide. And that's really the first part of precision medicine, trying to figure out who's at risk of something. Who should who's going to have the heart attack? That's the person we should be going and doing the intervention with. And then subsequently, the real core of precision medicine is when we have treatments that exist, or better yet, multiple treatments that exist, as we do in psychiatry, not just to predict who's at highest risk, but who is highest benefit among the people who get a treatment, who's the person that this treatment's most likely to help? And then if we do that in parallel for multiple treatments, we can splice that data together, to use a technical term, and say which of these treatment alternatives is the best one for person number one. And that could be very different from the situation for person number two. But it all starts in developing these risk models for how well will this particular treatment work for this particular person. And then we do that in parallel for many people and many treatments, and can fold it all together to try to come up with an optimization scheme for how to get the right treatment to the right person at the right time.
Okay, so it sounds like this method or these methods are possible when you have all these data points, which, like you're saying, we happen to have in the military. So is it possible to do this work with the general population, or are we going to have to really move toward collecting more data about individuals to even begin this precision medicine process? Or do we already have enough that we could start making some sense of what we already have?
Well, we certainly have enough data already to start looking at things, but it's also the case that the more data you have, the better a job you can do. There's a trade-off, of course, between the costs of the data collections and the benefits. And I think that one reason we kind of went down a rabbit hole in precision psychiatry is that the natural inclination is to say psychiatric disorders are real illnesses and we're real doctors and this is real biological stuff. So let's go do these biomarkers and we'll discover subtypes where we find these natural cleavages. There's not just a thing called depression, there's five depressions. And, you know, but it costs an enormous amount of money to do that kind of stuff. And it hasn't really panned out. And that doesn't mean it won't eventually, but up to now, we've spent an incredible amount of money on largely underpowered studies, the thinking being that, well, I can't afford to do this with thousands and thousands and thousands of people, so we'll do it with just a few hundred, and then we'll get sort of the signal, and then we'll see what's going on. It turns out, statistically, that if you only have a few hundred people, as many of these biomarker studies have, the noise that you get in the data overwhelms the signal. And in fact, you have a extremely high probability of coming up with what you think of as significant results that when you then go try it on a separate data set, it totally disappears because you're overfitting the data. So spending incredible amounts of money on underpowered, expensive studies is not really getting us any place. And I don't really know whether that realization has sunk in as much as it should in the field, but we've spent an awful lot of time in what turned out to be not a very productive line of investigation. So this thing of getting better measures is great, but we can't afford to do $10,000 specs for everybody to figure out whether a $350 intervention is going to be better or not. Just give them the $350 intervention and see if it works.
It sounds like you're saying it's also which pieces that you pick that you find are relevant, because if it's too much, like you said, you're overfitting. But is part of your work to figure out which pieces of data are relevant and important to be looking at?
Well, there's two pieces. There's the overfitting. I mean, you know, we have when you look at claims data, say, and we're trying to predict who's going to, have a heart attack or who's going to drop out of treatment or whatever it is we're looking at, we have literally thousands and thousands of pieces of information. And if we have strong priors about what's important, we can pick a subset and look at them. But very often it's the case that there are signals there to be discovered that you wouldn't have thought of previously. And so sometimes it makes sense to look at thousands of pieces of evidence. In genetic studies, for example, that's done, 500,000 SNPs you start with. But if you start out with 500,000 things, the chances of you finding something that looks significant is a certainty. So, very often you have these immense genetic samples, and they say, is something significant at the 0.01 to the minus 10th power? That's what you kind of look at. The problem there is that you only end up getting really the big effects. So I think it is useful to look at large samples of predictors, but you have to be thoughtful about how you do it. And so you've got to figure out ways of doing your analysis to minimize the chances of overfitting. And you also have to test your models in ways that allow us to discover overfitting when it exists.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seems like for things like cancer and heart disease, maybe they've come a long way with precision medicine. Why do you think precision medicine has progressed more slowly in psychiatry than other areas of medicine?
Well, it hasn't progressed all that much in heart disease. Cancer, it has progressed dramatically. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One big one is there's an enormous amount of money in cancer research. And also they have ready access to a lot of variables that are sort of the core variables they need to look at.
Okay.
The other thing is that virtually every other branch of medicine, not just cancer, but the ones that haven't progressed so far either, have many fewer treatments than we have. And so that's kind of a blessing and a curse in psychiatry that, you know, what you're interested in doing in precision treatment is to say, here are these, this range of things I can do. And is there a way of figuring out what the right one is for any one individual? And if I'm in the business of fixing people's broken arms, there's not really much value in precision medicine. There's only one thing you do when you go break your arm. You go to the emergency room and you get your arm set, right? But if you have depression, you can go to a minister or a social worker or a psychologist or a private, you know, I mean, there's all these things that each one of those people have a range of things they can do. So that makes it more complicated in psychiatry as well. There's this dizzying array of things that we can look at. But in the long run, when and if we get organized to march through this stuff, the potential value of precision medicine, it's much greater in psychiatry than other areas because it helps us with those much more complicated decisions. And not just complicated decisions, but because the mechanism of action is so different in a lot of those things, the possibility of getting something that works for a person out of that many different things is much greater than in other areas of medicine. Mm-hmm. You know, you can try five or six treatments for depression. They don't work and come up with a seventh and it just, boom, all of a sudden it works. You just don't have that option in places where there's only two treatments, you know?
Mm-hmm. Is part of this also because most of the way that we measure psychiatric symptoms is through self-reports? Do you think that adds to the complexity?
Yeah. I mean, having being unclear about what the phenotype is muddies things, certainly. But, you know, back to why are we not advancing more than we should advance? I don't think that's a major reason. And I say that because even though it's the case that there are a whole bunch of different measures of any mental disorder, when you look at treatment effects, you find pretty consistent results in trials where you is sticking with depression. If you have the Beck scale or the Zung scale or the CESD or the whatever, you know, if you find a treatment that works, it works. And the fine grain of exactly what the effect size is going to differ. But I think the signal is going to be there. The real challenge is you have to get good predictors, and we have pretty abysmal predictor sets in most studies that are done of trials, precision treatment trials that have tried to look at, does treatment A work better than treatment B at the simplest one? And there are many studies that have essentially looked at severity of depression, age, sex, three biomarkers that are pretty useless, and that's it. And it's not all that surprising that we're not going to find much of anything. There's now enough studies, most of them done by psychologists, because the specifiers that I think are most important at the moment are psychosocial ones. But there are probably 75 different variables that have been found to be predictive of differential response. And there's never been a trial that's measured all 75 of those variables. There's never been a trial that's measured half of those variables. And so the big problem is we don't have the right predictor set. And the second big problem is that the sample sizes that we have are too small. So we need big trials with rich sets of predictors. And once we have those two things, I think we're going to find that we can make progress in psychiatry equal to or greater than that in virtually any other area of medicine, despite the fuzzy phenotype.
Is that on the horizon? Do you see that? Is that in the work you're doing or the work you hope to
well,
do?
Well, certainly in the work I hope to do. and it's on the horizon, but it depends on how strong your binoculars are to look at and how far you look out at the horizon. We are involved in several big studies in the Veterans Administration, where we're looking at precision treatment for treatments for preventing suicide. And one where we're looking at treatments for depression. There's a big study that my colleague Andy Nuremberg is just starting with PCORI, looking at different treatments of depressive episodes among people with bipolar disorders. There's not that many medications approved for that. But these are pretty massive undertakings. So Andy's study, as I recall, is about $22 million. And it's pretty much on the edge of being big enough. I mean, you know, it's anything less than that would not really work. So it's a non-trivial thing to do serious studies of this sort. If we start getting into the world of measurement-based care, which I think is on the horizon, things are going to be a lot easier. That's another, by the way, another reason why it's more difficult in psychiatry than in some other areas of medicine. You mentioned cardiology. Whenever you go to your doctor's office, they take your blood pressure, they take your temperature, the height, but you don't get self-report scales of mental disorders typically. Even people who go to psychotherapy or go and see a psychiatrist, it's not common for them to get administered scales on an ongoing basis to see how they're doing. So it's harder for us to get objective measures of treatment response in routine data sets in ways that other areas of medicine have.
And what does that make you kind of think about, you know, clinical judgment in clinical work?
Well, that doesn't make me, you mean other than the fact that why do the clinicians have such poor judgment that they don't use measurement-based care? But what do you mean? Say more about what your question. I don't quite get what you're asking.
I guess like currently there is a subjective element in psychiatry, right? And psychology sometimes where it, you know, based on the clinicians, you know, assessing symptoms, would you prefer that we move into a more kind of objective way to measure symptoms? And then again, it sounds like some things that can't be even measured by a person.
Well, I think, just focusing on the measurement-based care stuff, I think it is valuable to have objective data on symptoms that we chart over the course of time and look at, compare treatment trajectories of individual patients to norms, to be able to say more quickly we might otherwise, whatever I'm doing is not working because the typical symptom course of a person who ends up remitting with the kind of treatment that I'm doing doesn't look like the course I'm seeing here. So it does give us an opportunity to switch treatments more quickly than we would otherwise. You know, there's standard protocol for try something for X number of weeks, and if it doesn't work, we move to something else. That could be short-circuited, and that's a piece of precision medicine too, since most people require multiple courses of treatment. I shouldn't say most, depends on the disorder, but many people require multiple courses of treatment before they're helped. The quicker we can, picking the right first treatment is really an important thing. Knowing how quickly to cut your losses when that first treatment is not working is an important thing. Figuring out what the right second treatment is an important thing. But the cutting your losses on the first treatment, that's where the measurement-based care comes in. If we can sort of look at, here's this person, and there's quite a bit being done in trials now, looking at interim kinds of measures that we get every 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, to predict at 8 weeks, this is pretty much doomed to a failure, and I can see that at 3 weeks. So let's not torture this poor patient for another 5 weeks and move them to stage two right now. So I think measurement-based care is useful there. I think the big thing is that we need to get better baseline information. And in trials, there's such a concern about making sure you can enroll enough people and the challenges of doing that, that very often trialists will get a baseline measure of whatever the outcome is they're interested in. They're doing a trial of PTSD, so they give them the PCL or whatever it is, and if they have that score, and get some other very basic kinds of stuff, and then do the trial. In the trials I'm involved with, we typically spend at least an hour assessing patients, not just the symptoms, but I mean an hour of getting information about things that could influence treatment response before we start. And that's a scary thing for people doing trials, because the concern is, are people going to sit through this hour and drop out? I guess my experience is that the people who don't sit through the hour are going to be people who are going to drop out of the trial anyway. I'm involved in several big trials now where I've been always pushing for getting a richer and richer and richer baseline assessment. I'm involved in a trial now with Steve Holland and Vikram Patel in India and a cast of others, where we started out with, I think, around 5 hours worth of data. We're boiling it down to probably 2 hours of a baseline assessment. But I think, and ultimately, we're not going to need 2 hours worth of information. Probably, you know, once the precision treatment rules get developed, maybe it will be 20 minutes worth of information we need to figure out what the right treatment is for that individual. The problem is, I don't know which 20 minutes out of my 5 hours is the right. So you have to start out with something to begin with. And then over the course of time, you sort of can throw things away. But I think that's a challenge. There's an understandable reluctance to do that. And then people have their own theories about things. There's lots of trials where people have their pet measure of cognitive something or other, and that's the only measure they have. And even though that measure could very well be useful, it is extremely unlikely that we're ever going to get to a point until we kind of get some magic biological thing and, you know, a measure of that particular kind of illness that we can do it. But in the absence of that, it's very, very unlikely that there's going to be one measure we have that will be all we need to tell us which treatment to use. So big samples with rich baseline assessments is what we need.
Yeah, and speaking of, a number of different measures, kind of moving into machine learning, you've applied machine learning to veterans' health, including calculating risk for PTSD, suicide, and even insomnia. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of that work and talk about what you've learned there?
Well, as I sort of vaguely alluded to earlier, there are two kinds of models, basically. One's something called a risk model. So we're interested in saying at the negative side, who is it among these? So for example, we're doing some work right now among people who are inpatients, psychiatric inpatients, and we're interested in a suicide after discharge from the hospital. And as you probably know, the suicide rate after discharge from a hospital is very high, and it's highest in the first week after discharge. It goes down over time. And in the U.S. population and in the Veterans Administration and in the Department of Defense, about 1% of the population is hospitalized a year. Those people account for between 12 and 15% of all suicides over the next year. And of those inpatients who subsequently go on to commit suicide, well over half the suicides occur in the 10% that are predicted to have high suicide risk by existing machine learning models. So we can say here are of the 100 patients who are in the hospital, these 10, that's where half of the suicides will be. The other half, we're not good at predicting. There are things that happen after they leave that we can't predict and so forth. And there are interventions that exist, these intensive case management, transitional services kind of interventions that can be effective in reducing risk of suicide, but we can't afford to give that to everybody. So just being able to target the high-risk people sometimes makes it possible for us to take something that we know has the potential to be a useful intervention, but isn't something that we can cost-effectively give to everybody and target it. So a lot of what we're doing is that. And there are lots of other areas in psychiatry where that kind of thing is being done. So you're probably familiar with over the past decade, since esketamine came along, there's been a number of trials. Who are the people who respond to that? Who are the refractive cases that do? And it's probably 40, 50% of cases respond to that. If we knew who those people were before we gave it to them, it's an expensive treatment. There are risk factors and so forth. So being able to do that is a useful thing. So those are the first kind of models. And at the risk end, there's who's the person who's going to have the heart attack? That's the one I've got to do the intensive. Or who's the person who's going to be at risk of suicide? He's the one I've got to do the special thing with. And at the flip side, who's the person who's going to respond to this treatment? That's the one where that treatment is indicated. And so there are lots and lots of places where that comes up. So that's the first kind of model, risk models. The second kind, as I mentioned earlier, is comparative risk models. So I'm at the moment involved in some work in DOD and looking at, you mentioned insomnia, which is a big deal among military people. They get up early in the morning, they have to do things in the middle of the night, stuff like that. And the recommended treatment is for insomnia there's a CBT for insomnia. There aren't a lot of people who know how to do that. It's relatively expensive. There's also all these Z drugs that are around, which are seem to be less effective, but they're a lot easier to deliver. So we have been developing models to say who are the patients that if they get a particular medication for insomnia, that that's likely to be effective for them. And we can actually do not a great job, but a lot better than chance. So there's only about a third of people who do well, but we can say in this 50% of people, about half of them will do well, and this other 50%, only 25% will do well. So we kind of double your probability of doing well. For ICBT, there's more people who do well, and it turns out it's a different profile of people. So we've developed things for that. If you only have so many people who you can deliver this intervention to, here are the ones where it's most likely to be effective. But then splicing those together to say, here's a person where medication is just as likely to work as the psychotherapy. And it's a lot cheaper and it's a lot easier to get, so they should get the medication. Here's people where the medication is definitely not going to work, and the psychotherapy has a high probability of, they're the ones who should get the psychotherapy. So those are the two kinds of models. First of all, when we don't have comparative treatments, we just have doing something versus doing nothing. Who are the people at risk? And then in cases where we have multiple treatments, trying to figure out models to say, how do you get the right treatment to the right person?
Yeah, it sounds like you're talking about like what works for, you know, the profiles, what works for one person, what won't work for someone else, and trying to find what's the most cost
right,
efficient
right.
manner
then cost
to get
comes
them the
in
treatment
there as
that they
well.
Need.
That's right. Yeah. As I said, you know, having a case manager, giving everybody a best friend that will come home and make supper for them is actually pretty, but we can't afford it for everybody. So figuring out how to juggle those things. And in the suicide world, that's a big thing. There have been a lot of concerns saying that these machine learning models are pretty useless because, you know, there's only 12 people out of 100,000 who will die by suicide, and the high-risk people, maybe 200 out of 100,000. I mean, can you afford to give an intervention to 100,000 people to, you know, that kind of thing. So we want to see if we can develop a model that has enough concentration of risk at the top that it's not just that, say, the 5% of people at highest risk account for 40% of all suicides, but that the risk of suicide in that population, that they have 1.5% of people are going to die by suicide, or 3.2% of people. What is the intervention that if it had an effect of X and it had a cost of Y, I could afford to give to a group of people where only 1% of them are going to have the bad outcome anyway? And it might be that the answer is nothing. There's just nothing that I could afford to do. Mm-hmm. If it's sort of fluoride in the water, you know, it sort of cost a penny, yeah. You know, I could do it. It turns out, though, that it's the answer to that question is not obvious. You know, the critics, as I said, have there was a whole exchange in JAMA Psychiatry and a couple of sort of ripples and things in other journals about this this critique of these suicide models, because positive predictive value is so low. The proportion of people who are actually going to die by suicide is so low that it just doesn't cost effective. But they were sort of seat of the pants ideas of saying, well, how can you afford to do that? Well, in fact, if you sit down and think of it carefully, the proportion of patients in, say, these inpatient suicide prevention models that I mentioned, the proportion who end up dying by suicide over the next year at the high risk level is a small number proportionally, but it's not different, say, from the proportion of people who would have a heart attack who are right now recommended to get statins. You know, it's 7 per 50,000 or something that. And why is that recommendation made for statins? Well, it was made literally sitting down by saying, here's how much it costs for a statin. Here's how many lives it's going to save per X. Mm-hmm. And something that we don't think of a lot, but you have to think about when you do this, is how much is a life worth? How much are we willing to pay to save 1 year of life? And the answer is $50,000 about. But there's you know, the U.S. government has a cost of a statistical life. In other words, they have values of here's what, and interventions, highway safety interventions of various sorts, if they are going to save X lives, they refer to those things. They say, if we refer those that many lives, here's how many millions of dollars we can afford to spend. No, we can't afford to spend it. So the question is, how much is a statistical life is worth $7 million, supposedly. But I mean, if you just sort of think of $100,000 for every year of life, it turns out that there's a question. Interventions that are the cost effectiveness threshold, the optimal threshold, is a lot wider than we think. And this is a level of thinking about precision medicine that you see in the cancer world, for example, that you don't see yet in the psychiatry world. There's something called decision analysis, net benefit analysis, where we sort of build these things. We literally can say, if you could tell me all those things, how much does it cost? What's the benefit? What's the risk ratio? Blah, blah, blah. I can tell you exactly who to intervene with. And when we have done those things in a hypothetical way so far in our precision treatment models, it turns out that these things have a considerable value. And when I say in a hypothetical way, there. We report these things. If you look at some of our stuff, we have net benefit curves across the range. And the reason for the range is I don't have a particular treatment in mind all the time. And that means I don't know how much it will cost because there's no it yet. I don't know how effective it will be because, you know, we haven't done it. And I also don't want to prejudge what the value is of the intervention. I mean, you know, how much is it worth to prevent a case of depression? I mean, how much are we willing to spend for that?
Yeah, and it sounds like what these models are trying to look at, and maybe people might not want to hear that, but there has to be, you know, in society, likely some sort of cost benefit. That's just the reality of the situation. And it sounds like something that could make this, you know, really positive is if, you know, we could have some AI supported medicine. So to minimize the cost. And so what have, what's the response from patients to recent experiments with AI supported medicine? What are your thoughts there?
When you say AI supported medicine, you mean the patient can go and tell the computer their symptoms and the computer can spit back things to them?
Yeah. Maybe like both about their diagnosis and then, hey, here are some helpful treatment interventions. You know, I know that CBTI created a Somryst app, and there are other things where they're saying, hey, this information is actually not terribly complex. It's accessible. A lot of CBT therapies are very accessible. So what are your thoughts about ultimately using that?
Well, it's a brave new world, and we don't really know. You know, there's a concern, but it's an exciting thing in psychiatry for a couple of reasons, because the reluctance of patients to ask or to tell doctors about these embarrassing kind of things are a lot greater than in other areas of the medicine. I mean, it's not the only place, you know, people who have impotence or hemorrhoids or who knows what, you know, there are other embarrassing things. But so that's a good thing. There's a concern, obviously, about medical misinformation, too. And so there's got to be a way of sort of monitoring that. And we've all heard about these kind of, you know, sometimes there are these crazy things that AI systems spit back at people. And those will become less and less common over time as these systems become refined. So I think there's a lot of promise. The healthcare providers are sort of freaked out by machine learning, which is much simpler than AI in spades, because it's kind of threatening their, you know, their hegemony. But like any other kind of technology, I think in the long run, if we figure out how to work with it, it could be helpful. There was a paper a number of years ago in, I think, the New England Journal of Medicine about the resistance to AI in healthcare that talked about, it was written by a historian, a medical historian, and it was about the stethoscope. The idea that when the stethoscope was first invented, that there was this terrible resistance against it, because it's like, I'm a doctor. I have trained ears. I listen to these things. I don't want this stupid thing. But I mean, you know, all kinds of, at the moment you think it was just kind of a nutty kind of thing, but that was sort of, that's very often the natural reaction to many, many things. You don't understand it. And this idea that there are these black box models, somehow that's a black box. I don't really understand what it's doing. I kind of thought, well, an X-ray is a black box. I mean, how many people know about the physics of it? You know, I don't, but, you know, I know how to read an X-ray. I mean, you know, those kind of things. So there are growing pains, I think, to integrating new technologies whenever they come along. But I think in the long run, AI has really incredible potential. I have a kid, I should say, who has a very rare autoimmune disorder. And it took us 10 years to figure out what he had, and he's doing great now, which is wonderful. But when ChatGPT first came along, my wife went to it and punched it and said, what would you say if you had a patient who had this, and not this? And it immediately came back and said, oh, they have GA2, blah, 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 blah.
Wow.
It took us 10 years to get that. You know, so.
Yeah. So if we could find a way to have the algorithms work for us and still find a way to, you know, deliver compassionate care, but also, like you said, a lot of things that we use, you know, an x-ray is impersonal in a way, but it's, you know, hey, if you're actually getting better and we, you know, maybe we're using some impersonal ways to understand your symptoms and help you get better, I think people would prefer that over, you know, just kind of therapeutic alliance, right?
Yeah, yeah. This is a little bit of a scant, but the, as you probably know, during the COVID pandemic, the reluctance to have telepsychiatry sort of fell by the wayside by kind of fiat, and then sort of seeing patients, seen inside their homes, and so there's this visual stuff, and clinicians all of a sudden see the houses where their patients live, which they didn't see before, the kids running around, and people all of a sudden discovered, gee, my no-show rate is going down. I thought the patients didn't like me. It really is that there's these, you know, I mean, but there's all these kind of funny things that happen. But the other thing that happened is that, which we don't really know a great deal about, but patients are willing to tell things to their mental health treatment provider over the internet that they don't tell them face to face, because there's a certain psychological distance that will allow you to say something. And we know this from doing research that when you ask people about sort of embarrassing things, the highest rates you get when you go to a classroom and say, tell us about something or other, and fill out the form and don't write your name, just drop it in a box over there. You hear about high rates of these embarrassing things. When you say and sign your name, the rate goes down. When you call them on the telephone and do the same, it goes down farther. When you show up at their house and look at them face to face, it goes down farther yet. So there's sort of a way in which psychological distance allows you to say things. But it also, I can't reach out and touch you. You know, I mean, there's a certain way in which the alliance you have with the patient, there's some things that you can have them say to you, but there's sort of something missing as well. And how do you get the good part without the bad part of that? I mean, you know, there's sort of that funny stuff. There are pluses and minuses of everything.
Yeah, it's worth the height of AI growing while we also have, you know, according to the Surgeon General, a loneliness epidemic.
Yes,
so
right.
Threading the needle of what we need is really fascinating, and which I think you're trying to get at with precision medicine
yeah,
here.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Well, for my final question, just kind of what do you hope to see in, you know, the next 5-10 years with your research, like, and that clinicians could ultimately utilize too?
Well, we are just my little group, but in general, this is happening, developing a number of clinical decision support tools that are starting to be put into place that we think are going to make the lives of clinicians easier, help in making decisions, maybe save lives. I'm right now in my next hour talking to somebody about a thing we just had come out, I think last month in JAMA Psychiatry, where we had a precision treatment model of somebody comes to an emergency department who's suicidal, what should you do? And the standard of care is supposed to be that you hospitalize them, you stabilize them, come with a treatment plan, you discharge them. But in fact, only about 50% of such people get hospitalized in America because not having enough beds and people resisting and so forth. So we've developed a model which showed that there are about 20% of these patients in the Veterans Administration who really need to be hospitalized. If you don't hospitalize them, you're pretty significantly increasing their risk of being dead pretty soon. There's another group of people of almost equal size, which is interesting, where they really should not be hospitalized. This is sort of DBT thinking that, you know, the people need to learn how to, but the idea of that it hurts them to be hospitalized. And it not only is characteristics of the patients themselves that predict that, but also characteristics of the environment. So if they have good PAC programs or good intensive case management, outpatient, partial hospitalization programs in their community, hospitalization actually for those people is bad because there are these other alternatives. And there's another 60% makes no difference. So it turns out that our simulations suggest that if what is currently done in VA was replaced with what we suggest, the suicide rate among people coming to emergency departments with suicidal would go down by close to 20%. But interestingly, the number of people hospitalized would go down by 20%, which in the world we live in, where there's a massive boarding crisis for in many emergency departments, is pretty cool. I mean, you sort of a win-win situation. So we're in the midst of having conversations with the VA leadership in emergency medicine to put in place a demonstration project in some VAs where we try this out. If it works, then that would become something that's a protocol that we could do. You know, reducing the number of hospitalizations by 20% in that segment of the population and saving 20% more lives, not a bad thing. And if we can get one or two or three or four of those things to become realities, I think that will sort of jumpstart a realization that this world of precision medicine is something that has value for psychiatry. It would sort of, I think, open the floodgates. That's my hope.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation. Great information. And we really appreciate you on the podcast.
My pleasure. Good talking to you. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for that conversation, Dr. Kessler. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to rate and subscribe to NYU Langone Insights on Psychiatry on your podcast app. For the Department of Psychiatry at NYU Langone, I'm Dr. Thea Gallagher. See you next time.